Podcasting from a secret location deep inside the political colossus. This is Radio Free GOP, the voice of the Republican resistance.
Part of the beauty of me is that I'm very rich. Let me tell you, I'm a really smart guy.
What's your name again?
John Miller.
Yes, that's correct.
Oh my God, they've got a madman on their hands.
We will have no truth nor parley with you or the grisly gang who work your wicked will. You do your worst, and we will do our best.
We've come to a turning point, a moment for hard decisions. If not us, who? And if not now, when?
It's 11:59 at Radio Free America, and this is Uncle Sam with music and the truth until dawn. Right now, I got a few words for some of our brothers and sisters in the occupied zone. The chair is against the wall. The chair is against the wall.
This is Radio Free GOP with your host, Mike Murphy.
Welcome. This is it. Episode one of Radio Free GOP, the resistance podcast. I'm Mike Murphy. Thank you for clicking in to join us. And please poke me with a stick. Wake me up. End the nightmare here. I mean, what a week. Hillary Clinton has tied up more FBI agents than the Alvin Karpis gang now for about a year. Yet, during what could have been the worst week of her political career, our apparent nominee, henceforth known as the Orange Plague, decides to ruminate about Saddam Hussein, admirable figure, declare war on the frozen princess, and insanely deny that the anti-Semitic tweet his henchman blasted out on his tweet account was in fact anti-Semitic. Instead, it was a sheriff star. You know, I looked at some old photos of Europe in the late 30s. A lot of sheriff stars around. Huh, I'll bet Mr. Trump thinks they had no crime. So that was it. How to snatch a Republican crack up from the jaws of potential victory. If only we had an accretive candidate, what a difference it would make. A candidate who can actually attract votes, not repel them. Can the change? Sure it can. We have the Republican convention coming up. Parties make their own rules. Delegates can. And I frankly think 2/3 of the delegates on that floor at least are anti-Trump. It's a shotgun convention. They're voting for him at gunpoint. And if the Rules Committee voted accordingly, we could democratize the convention and open it up so we don't ask people to make a pilgrimage to Cleveland to spend 4 days essentially signing a suicide note for the Republican Party. Will it happen? Well, we'll have more details about that next week as we dive into our special convention episode and do some analysis about it. But it's uphill, legally possible. But will Republicans buck the pressure to just slowly walk off a cliff here? I don't know. I think the pressure to do something is building because every day gets worse for Trump and better for Hillary Clinton. If you look at the metrics of the campaign, the kind of hard-eyed politics of it all, it's pretty clear. Trump's got no money. Hillary is crushing him on television with negative ads that have the unfortunate reality of being true about all Trump's various failures and the way he's insulted the swing voters that he needs so badly to actually win in all the states that count. Well, Trump is silent because they haven't raised any money. Now, they put out a press release, I believe, last night saying they've raised $30 million. Mark me down as believing it when I see an FEC report. And this is Trump we're dealing with. This is Trump University bunko artist Donald Trump. But I hope they have raised a bunch of money into that RNC joint account because the RNC has a lot of work to do helping elect Republican governors, senators, congressmen, and other elected officials, and they need money. So if you're a donor out there, keep giving money to the RNC. So we'll see what the money reality is, but we know the Trump roadshow reality is really bad. We know Trump can't stay on message. He made a change. I'll give him that. I saw the speech yesterday on television, and he migrated from the normal insane nutty rant to a drunken wedding toast. Maybe that's an improvement. I don't know. I thought the mosquito beat him on rounds, by the way. He finally got a good jab in. So all in all, it was pretty bad. It did feature the inclusion of vice presidential possibility Newt Gingrich. When it comes to winning elections, I got to say, if Newt Gingrich is the answer, I am extremely suspicious of the question. But we'll see. Somebody's got to take that job. Nobody's saying will. And if you look at any kind of fair-minded analysis of the impact of vice presidents, they don't have that much impact. And if Trump got some superstar drunk and got him to agree to take it, all that would do is make Trump look smaller vis-a-vis the superstar. Worst thing for Trump is to have a qualified person around. It diminishes him. So who will it be? You know, I don't know. I guess I believe the conventional wisdom. Chris Christie wants it. He's the most accomplished, I guess you'd have to say, person in the broken down Trump orbit. So maybe it'll be him. Maybe it'll be Jeff Sessions, senator from Alabama. Been very loyal to Trump as a real Trump supporter. But he doesn't bring you anything. Trump will win Alabama, I think. So that's not accretive. It doesn't grow the campaign, doesn't help him win. And then, Bob Corker and Joni Ernst, who are both rising, up-and-coming, and impressive Republican senators, clearly passed the sanity test by bolting for the door a day or two after their names got mentioned. Marco Rubio's announced he's not going to the convention. I mean, this is an interesting convention. You got to admit, we're 2 weeks out. Our nominee's in a cold war with the party. We're getting killed on television everywhere with no response. And you cannot get a Republican started this convention with a bulldozer. It is just, it's unheard of. I've never seen anything like it. So my guess is the VP will be one of those names, or maybe a general that Trump finds somewhere to try to burn his weak foreign policy credentials. So we'll see. But it's pretty glum stuff. Pretty glum stuff. Well, let's talk about the impact of the Hillary thing for a minute. And then we'll get to our first interview with the one and only, my friend, Mitt Romney. We did a two-parter with Mitt. We went down to his Western headquarters down near San Diego. We'll be talking to him in a minute. But first, I want to dive deep into this Hillary disaster. But before I do that, we've got some bills to pay. So let's do a commercial.
All across the nation, let's put crazy on the run. Tell your friends to listen in. Our podcast will be fun. Radio Free GOP.
You know, running a global podcast empire like this, it isn't cheap. I've got a vast squad of con men, grifters, yes men, fugalmen, technicians. You name it, I've got one. And they're not inexpensive. Jingle singers alone, they like top dollar. So I'm lucky that we found a sucker to pay for all our high overhead here at Radio Free GOP. Who is it? It's me. And I'm tired of paying the bills, so we're going to start having some advertising. And this, in the middle of the podcast, is where we do what my producer and friend Jeff Baron Fox tells me is the most lucrative type of advertising, live read ads, where I actually read the sales copy. So here we go. Okay, we don't have any live read ads because we're brand new, but I'm going to do a quick live read ad for us, which is, dear advertisers, try us out. We have a loyal listener. When Jeff first came to me to talk about advertising, he did ask me if I had any scruples about taking some of these more controversial but frequent podcast advertisers. Scruples, I said. I'm a political consultant. I checked mine at the door a long time ago. Bring them on. I'll read a ransom note if the money is right. So, gold coin bugs, come on in. We want you. Who needs paper money? Save gold coins, because after that zombie apocalypse, you're going to want gold coins to calmly negotiate on your doorstep with the Mad Max horde of barbarians who are threatening you. That's what they want. Canadian maple leaf coins. They'll treat you so nicely on a nifty handshake if you only have a few to barter. No, they won't make a hat out of your face. They're going to want those gold coins. So gold coin advertisers, we are here to serve and read your scripts. How about this? You want to get rich overnight in real estate? You want to know the secrets of known billionaires? Trump University, Diploma Mill, send us the script. No, we wouldn't take that one. Maybe the gold coins, not that one. And then finally, how about some classy podcast advertisers? I'm sitting here right now and I've got a problem. I'm looking at this banged up old postage machine. Boy, I wish there were some high-tech way to buy postage, maybe involving the internet, some sort of .com. If only there was a product like that that I could advertise on this show and talk about with glee and recommend my loyal listeners give a 30-day free trial. I'm here. Give us a call. But seriously, there is a way to help us out, which is check out our t-shirts, high-quality, American-made t-shirts. We checked out the slave labor factories that Donald Trump prefers, and we said, no, we're going with American workers making a decent wage because we want a t-shirt that doesn't crumple up after 2 days, doesn't disintegrate after going in the wash. We want something that'll last longer than a Trump campaign promise. So our first t-shirts, American made, by the excellent American Apparel brand, a high-quality item. They're coming out. They're fashion-forward. They come in navy with our logo, the upside-down elephant in distress on it, or that's our formal version, or in white with a red elephant in distress logo on it. The white one has a handy double purpose because if Trump does somehow miraculously win and the Trump troopers surround your house, you can turn it inside out and it becomes a handy surrender flag as you lure them in to what I'm sure will be a spirited ambush. So that's the merch. It's on our website, radiofreegop.com. Check it out. Order yours today. Supplies are limited. Now, back to work.
Fight for sanity.
Sanity.
In this crazy year on Radio Free GOP.
Okay, Hillary Clinton, here's the big question. Will anybody care who's a swing voter? The Republican base knows she's untrustworthy. That's already locked in. The Democratic base, they're going to vote for a bag of potatoes with a D on it. They're locked in for her. So what about the 8 or 9% in the middle that's persuadable? I think it's a mixed bag. We're in a politics now of I'm right, you're evil. So it's hard to move swing voters. They're so cynical about everything. And the big problem we have, the massive orange tornado headwind, is that Donald Trump is less trustworthy and more despised even than Hillary Clinton. But even though the FBI didn't recommend criminal prosecution, this reinforces a narrative that's already stuck to her with swing voters. That she cannot be trusted. That she's kind of been captured by politics. And I think that could help. The problem is, will it help enough to overcome the weaknesses of Donald Trump? And my sad analysis is it will not. So we'll see. Something can still be done. We're going to Cleveland. We're packing our gas mask. We will be there. We'll be reporting back for Radio Free GOP what's going on. But the sun is setting here, and it's up to that rules committee to step back and think about what a Trump nomination at this point in the race really, really means. Now, let's turn to brighter subjects. I had a tremendous time visiting my old friend Mitt Romney. I worked for Mitt. I was his consultant when he ran for governor of Massachusetts. We had a lot of fun. We did a little memory lane looking at that. And then later in part two of our interview, we talked about the current state of the GOP, the Orange Menace, and where the party might be going in 2020. I also asked him the mega question, which we're going to save for the second of our two interviews. Now, a little precursor, because I know what you're thinking when I say Mitt Romney interview at his house in the San Diego area. You're thinking about the elephant in the room. You're thinking about the car elevator. Well, I've seen it. I'm one of the first to break the story of inspecting the famous and much maligned, frankly, Romney car elevator. So here's the real scoop. Mitt lives on a cul-de-sac with a very narrow street because he's near the water. Real estate has value there. Nobody's making any room for, say, parking spaces. You can't park on the street. So Mitt has a two-car garage that looks very normal, kind of a Brady Bunch garage. Except, here's the trick. When one of the 117 grandchildren visit, where do they park? Where can they go? Well, there's room in the basement to stash another car or two because of the much maligned car elevator. Now, I don't know about you, but I like the fact that I live in a country where if you work hard in the private sector and do well, and you live on a cul-de-sac of no street parking, and you're kind of mechanically inclined, you can get a car elevator. You don't have to write a 40-page letter to some commissar somewhere to get permission to see if Bernie Sanders thinks you ought to have a car elevator in the people's paradise. So I'm all for car elevators. Now, let me tell you what the thing looks like, because it's incredibly anticlimactic. You pull into a two-car garage. There's kind of a small black square outline around one of the cars. There's not even room to stand next to the car and descend. You click a switch, and the pad on the floor goes down 10 feet, and bingo, there's some room down at the basement level to slide the car off and stash another car or two down there. There you go. That's it. The car elevator. We have an incompetent president because people don't like the idea you can stash another car in your basement. It's ridiculous. We wanted to parody it. Our original plan for the interview was to get a pair of folding chairs and have Mitt just do the interview with us riding up and down on the car elevator, but it's too noisy. So instead, we retreated to the comfort and beautiful view of the ocean in Mitt's office in his house. So here is part one of our two-part interview of my friend, our former nominee, Governor Mitt Romney.
It's time to ask some questions.
Free GOP. So here we are. I don't even do an introduction to this stuff. I'm too lazy. Why? We just kind of fade in.
People know who you are. They know who I am.
Well, they know who you are. Me, they just changed the channel. They're like, oh, hell, him again? You know, yeah. We've heard it before. What is a typical Mitt Romney day now?
Well, I'm finally doing what I've always told people I would do, which is to be balanced in my life. So I, one, have about a quarter of my life that's devoted to business, and that's private equity and real estate, primarily with my sons. Another portion is devoted to charity. Ann has something called the Ann Romney Center for Neurologic Research, and I work with that, another group called Charity Vision. The next branch relates to politics. I'm out campaigning for people in the Senate and the House that I think need to get reelected to make sure we have real leadership in Washington again.
I mean, it must be kind of an interesting guest star kind of vibe.
I am now the person that introduces the candidate and stand behind the candidate and applaud and so forth. And I must admit, it's somewhat painful because I see my own mistakes. I see these people coming along and giving their pitch, and I realize, boy, that's exactly what I did. I can't, and I'm still doing it, and I've got to learn not to do it. So, for instance, they don't boil their message down to a real simple, here's how it's going to make your life better if you elect me kind of message. And I did the same thing. I talked about all sorts of issues instead of just focusing on one or two and driving those home. And I watch candidates do that, and it's like, oh, boy, you're making a mistake. You've got to figure out the one or two things you're going to talk about.
It must be weird when you're standing there. You've done the introduction, and they're doing their thing, and you're kind of watching the crowd, and you're seeing a yawn or two, or you're watching them and thinking they may be veering off. You know, you start to wonder, crash and burn, you eye the exit.
Yeah, but it's nowhere near as pressure-filled as it was when I was the person on the stage giving the speech, knowing that the media was watching what I might do, how I might react, how the audience was going to react. So I would agonize. If there was a little debate going on between people in front, or if there were protesters that were yelling, my staff said, you can't look at the protesters, because if you do, then the rest of the audience knows exactly where to look. They'll all turn around and look as well. And yet it's very hard when you're the person that everybody's looking at, not to sort of agonize over every little thing going on in the audience.
You've got to kind of slow your brain down, which is hard.
I think the hardest thing is to say, what is it I really want to have these people understand and communicate that, and pretty much that alone, and not respond to all the things in the news that day, not respond to all of the issues that you've been briefed on that you care about, but instead say, hey, here's how your life will be better if you elect me to the office I'm seeking.
I worked for you when you ran for governor, and we'll talk about that a little bit more, but I remember you would think through a lot of things. We had a very affectionate joking nickname back then, which was the reluctant astronaut. Because backstage, you'd be like, I could tell you were an investor because you would think through the downside. You don't want to have an impairment. You had a huge reputation. I don't know if we ever told you this among your staff, is just keep pushing and the feet will be going the other way. But the minute he gets out there, he's a total clutch player. And I can't remember one time in that gubernatorial race where you didn't get out and do the business and do it well. But backstage, the last 10 feet sometimes was a shove, as I recall.
Well, I must admit, it is fun being on the stage. All right, if you've got your thoughts are in line and you've got a good audience and they're with you, there's nothing more fun than being able to do that. And it's also fun if you get an audience that's not with you. If you know that going in, you're prepared for it, you can go in there and just hammer it away. But they talk about the smell of the grease paint and the roar of the crowd. There's no question there's a lot of that in politics too.
Even when I'm out on the speaking circuit, you know, and I have jokes and material, when you get a room really laughing, there's a certain adrenaline jolt there.
There's no question. And I would sometimes be asked, how in the world do you keep the schedule you've got, particularly in a presidential campaign where we might do multiple rallies in a day and fundraisers, maybe 7 speeches in a day, press interviews, early morning to late at night. And they'd say, you know, how can you handle it? And the truth is, you get a lot of energy from the people you're speaking to. And at the end of the day, I'd normally have to get on my bed and thank Gideon for putting a Bible in the nightstand, because I'd read that and go to sleep, because otherwise I just couldn't go to sleep. I was so full of energy from the people I'd spoken with.
The roughest part about one of these things when it doesn't work out is the way everything stops on one day, because you go from that meteor where you're the engine pulling a very big train, but it's pure adrenaline. You get all the energy back from the crowd and then it just stops. Am I right? Is that the hardest part of
one of these? There's no question. It's a shift. I mean, it's not fun losing. It's not fun knowing that what you were trying to do isn't going to get done. But for me, I live my life in the private sector. I have my kids and grandkids. That was my life. Politics was kind of a detour from regular life. And getting back to regular life wasn't at all bad. I actually think the hardest thing in politics is watching someone else. So I would watch Ann as I was in the debates, and she was dying because she's wanting to answer the question differently. Oh, Mitt, don't say this. I remember one time, by the way, during our campaign, you may remember this, we were debating Ted Kennedy in Springfield, Massachusetts, and I said Iraq. And my mom, who was about five rows back, said, no, it's Iran. All right. And my dad turned to her and said, shut up, Lenore. And I was right. She was wrong. But it's just, it's so hard to watch someone else.
No, I saw that tape, I remember, when we were preparing for the debates in the governor's race.
Oh, yeah.
But you're right. Your supporters want to jump out of the chair.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they're living in like
micro time. And you as the guy getting paid to do a good job for the candidate. I mean, you're going to get blamed for my mistakes.
Right.
And you're sitting there watching me blow an answer or blow an event of some kind. And there's nothing you can do about it other than when I'm finished saying, great job.
Right. But on the other hand, you're going to live with my mistakes. Hey, the dancing kangaroo spot, Mitt, it's going to take you all the way. So, you know, it's a symbiotic relationship. I remember back in the governor's race, I would be in the a couple of times. I remember we would have a little cipher code. And the only hand signal I'd ever give was slow down.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
you're a fast speaker. I remember that.
It was helpful. I don't know whether you've told people about your little signals, but you had that.
This is it. The world debut.
You had
the
slow down, but you also put your hand over your heart, which is, you know, speak with passion. Speak right. like you mean it. Don't just rattle off a little ditty you've got. And I'd look at your signals, but by and large, you were giving me the thumbs up, which is obviously the best way to feel about a debate.
Well, yeah, you always want your candidate to feel 20 feet tall because then they act like it, and it generally works out. I remember in a Jeb debate, he had had a rough debate in his 94 race, and it was a comeback, so I was the new guy in the race. And somebody, it wasn't me, but somebody had the idea for the first debate to put the silver fox in the front row.
And Barbara Bush.
Yeah, Barbara Bush. And Buddy McKay, the lieutenant governor, who people forget started out a little bit ahead of us. You know, it was I think he had a couple of 3x5 cars with attack lines that got slid aside. He was a well-mannered guy. And it just, people forget when they watch these things, there's the television psychology and there's the psychology in the room. And one thing I think has made the debates worse is we're now doing Roman Coliseum presidential debates where it's all screaming and applause meters in the room.
That's a problem. That's a real problem. I remember one debate I had where the audience was very clearly a Ron Paul audience. And Stuart Stevens, who was there, said, Mitt, if the audience is cheering you, you're not saying what you ought to be saying, right. all right? Right? Don't worry about the audience here because they're not going to be with you.
But it's hard. You're going to feel that audience because you're naked on a rock in front of 600 screaming people you think hate you.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I thought they really should have done the podiums, cameras, and nothing else debates.
I really think that's a better way to go.
It's better television.
I think it's a better chance to see the candidate rather than having crowds in there that are cheering one way or the other. And we obviously learned as the debates went on, it's like, okay, we've got to get our donors out of that room. We've got to get some young people in that room who will scream and holler. It's like, this gets silly. And all the campaigns were doing that. It really distorts the reality of the candidates' positions.
Yeah, no, it just becomes a dumb reality show. that disease seems to be everywhere. Let's do a little memory lane on the old 2002 campaign because we had a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think people knew that occasionally, just to get out of the pressure and sanity of a hard-fought campaign, there was a great inside joke, which was there was a movie, and we would work subtle references into the campaign trail. You want to tell that story?
Oh, sure. The movie is Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? Mm-hmm. And this is one of the most wonderful movies imaginable. I saw it the first time and didn't think it was that good. It was okay, but, you know, a friend called and said, you got to see this movie again. It's like, no, I've already seen it. No, you got to see it again. Saw it again. It was a lot funnier. By about the 10th time I've seen it, the thing is hilarious. George Clooney is absolutely just a killer in this film. And a lot of the lines in it and a lot of the stunts that are used, political stunts in that film, we used in our campaign.
Right, no, exactly. Well, we started doing this postmodern thing where occasionally brooms would show up at the rally.
Because at Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, the candidate was Pappy O'Donnell or whoever was using little brooms and saying, we're going to sweep the Capitol clean. And so we would have events where we'd hand out little brooms to people. And I'd say, we're going to sweep this clean. we were pulling their stunts.
But there were a lot of like grins and everything, because even though it was appropriate that you were cleaning up the mess on Beacon Hill was the theme, it just living inside the campaign and watching that movie, it all kind of hit a moment, and that I remember that became kind of our great inside wink through the campaign. We had a lot of fun. I've met a lot of business guys who run, and I've known a lot of professional politicians who run. It's rare to have somebody who's been successful in both worlds at a high level. But what the politicians all say is, oh God, not another fundraiser where there's business. Some guy who invented the wooden toilet seat is going to come up and straighten me out about how the world's problems will work. You know, these business guys don't get it. And then the business guys all say, those morons in Washington, if I could only get there, take me 2 days and some post-it notes and I'd fix everything. You've been on both sides of that equation. What do you think each side doesn't know or doesn't give enough credit to the other for?
Well, on the political side of things, you begin with a campaign. And a campaign is entirely different than anything you've experienced in business. So when people from the business world start telling you what kind of ad you ought to run or what kind of event you ought to do or which positions are going to be the most interesting to people, they generally don't have the background to be credible in that kind of a discussion.
And they don't know that.
They don't know that.
Yeah.
And they're really smart people and believe they have the kind of insights you need. So I remember Meg Whitman, for instance, before she ran for governor of California, was a close friend of mine. We worked at Bain together. During my campaign for president in 2008, a number of times she met with me, one time with the, you know, overhead transparencies and here's how you've got to present yourself. Here's what you're doing wrong. Here's the right. Anyway, after all this was over and she ran for governor, she had been running for maybe a month and I got an email from her saying, I just want to say, I'm sorry.
she's a very good person.
Yeah. She's a very good person. And she said, oh my goodness, this is so very, very different than anything you and I had experienced in the private sector. So the campaign is very different. The actual governing, there's a lot of shared experience, a lot of learning from the private sector that can apply in the public sector. It's not just finding the answer. It's getting people to do what needs to be done. And I think people in government don't understand how much can be learned from the private sector. America leads the world, not because of our government, but because of free people, their innovation, and the private sector that thrives. The private sector has a lot to teach government about how to make something work, including government, how to get government to work. So I found running for governor in Massachusetts to be an entirely different experience than I'd ever had in the private sector. But I found the lessons from the private sector when I became governor to be directly applicable. And I felt that I was able to get things done in part because of my experience in management and leadership in the private sector.
One of the things that's always struck me about candidates, particularly running for president, is they have to have such incredible patience. Because how many people, when you were running for president, came up to you at fundraisers, you know, well-intentioned supporters and said, Mitt, people think you're stiff. You know, like you've never heard that,
yeah,
you know,
right. You hear the same advice day in and day out. The most frequent advice is just be yourself. Don't listen to your advisors. Just be yourself. I've sent emails to Jeb and Marco and others whose advice I was giving them advice rather that they didn't solicit. And I'd say, just be yourself. Ha, ha, ha. And it's the most frequent thing that you hear. And the reality is you are being yourself and you're listening to other people to find out what advice they have for how you give answers and so forth. But I am what I am, as Papa used to say, and that's just the way it is, folks. And part of the challenge that you have as a candidate is that the media creates a narrative, and then anything you do that fits that narrative is blasted around the world day in and day out, and somehow that becomes people's perception of you.
There's a great Quayle story where a rather famous Southern political boss who will remain nameless came up to him at a line and said, people think you're stupid, so you got to learn Russian, because you learn Russian, they think you're smart. And then he got mad because nobody was writing it down. You know,
gosh.
You kid, write this down. People think he's stupid.
I still get these, Mike. Get long letters from people telling me what I ought to do and what I'd do differently if I were to run again. It's just astonishing. But every now and then, the people that come up to you do surprise you with their brilliance or with their humor. I was one of the Northwestern states. And a guy came up to me, looked like he was 80, he had a cowboy hat on. And he looked at me and he said, so that's what a Mormon looks like. And I was a bit taken aback. And he said, don't be offended. He said, I've got 13 kids. People come up to me and they say, are you a Catholic or Mormon or just a sloppy Protestant? And so I got a good chuckle and haven't forgot that interchange.
Yeah. I bet he's a Trump delegate now with that political finesse and correctness he has. What was it back in 93 or 94? I didn't work for you on that first race, but there you were up-and-coming business guy, things were really working out, you had a young family, and then you hit your head or what? Something happened that made you decide to enter politics. What was it?
I think people would be surprised, but it was poverty, not mine. It was the poverty of the American people. And what concerned me was that the policies that Ted Kennedy was pursuing while they flowed from a great heart on his part, the policies were locking people in poverty from generation to generation. And he was running for re-election. It was going to be a cakewalk for him, of course. And I thought, somebody's got to get up there and give him a run for his money, or at least tell him that he's wrong, that his policies are hurting people, not helping people. And I told my partners at Bain Capital at the time, look, don't clean out my desk. Don't move my things out. This is just going to be, 6 months of leave of absence, because a Mormon millionaire from Massachusetts is not going to beat Ted Kennedy from Massachusetts. And I did not beat him, of course, but was able to
talk. He had some good wounds on his knuckles at the end of the campaign. No, look, gave him a workout.
I mean, everybody said, he's going to collapse. He won't be able to make it. He's never faced a tough election. Why? You can't believe this guy. They said, he's alcoholic. He can't. You know what? He was phenomenal. When the time came to dig deep, the guy dug deep, and he did a great, great job. Yeah,
people are in the major leagues for a reason.
Boy, that is for sure. Yeah. And people who dismiss the Kennedys are making a huge, huge error. They have real talent. And by the way, I learned after I became governor some years later that he and I were able to work together. Even though we disagreed politically on a lot of things, we found some common ground. And I found that he was an interesting person to be around, and a hard worker, and darn smart.
When you, that first race in 94, you talked about poverty and the problem of poverty drawing you in. Was part of that because you were at a place in your life where you just kind of hit the business jackpot, right? You had started out of Bain and things started working out, and you probably kind of became aware of wealth because your life changed a bit. Am I reading too much
into it? No, I think you're reading too much into where I was at that point, because we hadn't really hit the jackpot at that point, although things were doing darned well and it looked very, very good. But I was serving as a pastor in my church for congregations. I had multiple congregations that I helped oversee that included people from Cambodia, a whole congregation of Cambodians, Spanish-speaking people as well, so from Latin America, a couple of congregations, and a lot of people that were poor. And we had one branch of my church, one congregation that was in the inner city of Boston, largely African-American. And I saw the challenges associated with poverty in this country and how the safety net programs oftentimes can lock people in such a way that going back to work is going to make it more difficult for them. It's going to take away their earnings. It's going to make their standard of living go down. And I saw that what Kennedy was doing was really, in my opinion, harmful. Remember one time I was in a neighborhood of Boston. I looked around, there were all these boarded up buildings, and a fella came up to me, an African-American guy, and he said, "What are you doing here? This is Kennedy country." And I said, "Look around. It looks like Kennedy country." Because after this war on poverty that they had declared, people weren't getting out of poverty. They were getting locked into intergenerational poverty. So that's really what drew me into the race. Look, Mike, you know this. I would not be a conservative if I didn't believe that conservative principles are the most able to get people out of poverty and the most able to help middle-income people have a more prosperous future. That's why I'm conservative. It's not for the rich people. The rich people do fine who's ever elected. As a matter of fact, there's an argument that can be made. The rich people do better under Democrats. Look at these guys out in Silicon Valley. They're getting money out of the administration, under the Obama administration. They would have never gotten out of a conservative administration. No, the rich people do fine with liberals. But it's the poor and the middle-income families that need conservative principles to get higher wages and more prosperity in their lives.
When you lost that race because Massachusetts chose a Kennedy over a Mormon Republican millionaire, did you think, okay, this science experiment is over, I'm going back into business, life goes on? Or did you kind of file away in the back of my head, maybe another time I've got the bug?
No, I never thought I would ever run for office. I have to be honest with you. There didn't seem like there'd ever be a window open for Republican in Massachusetts. My business was beginning to really thrive. We'd had a couple of big home runs, but the business itself was on its way to be more successful. I couldn't imagine that I'd be into politics. So I went back to work. Fortunately, if I'd have thought politics was in my future, I'd have been spending my time going around to Republican town council meetings. And so I didn't do any of that.
That's thin gruel in Massachusetts. Yeah. I've been there. So have you. That's life on Jupiter there.
Yeah. So I didn't ever imagine that I'd be involved in politics again.
What do we construct so the middle class looks at us and say, that's my ticket up?
Yeah, and I think, by the way, Paul Ryan is doing a heck of a fine job doing that. I mean, he's said, look, I'm going to take 247 members of the House, Republicans, and we're going to get them all to come together on six major policy fronts. And it seems like he's done that.
Yeah.
Which is absolutely extraordinary. And it relates to helping people out of poverty, improving the prosperity of the middle class in America, and so forth. And I believe that has to be the future of a successful Republican Party. And our great challenge, in my view, is that the Democratic Party has very wisely and effectively characterized us as being the party of the rich, meaning for the rich. And while nothing could be further from the truth, that has stuck on us and makes people who are poor and are middle class think that we're not for them. And this
perception is reality in this crazy business.
Perception is reality. Right. I stepped into that. I was unable to shake that image. And that's one of the reasons I lost. I didn't run for office to help wealthy people. The wealthy people are doing fine in America. I ran for office to help the middle class and to help people come out of poverty. And yet, that's not the image. And I knew that. We all know what the Democrat playbook is. They've had the same playbook for 50 years. But it has stuck to us. It's something we're going to have to shift. If we're going to get, for instance, not just angry people, but we're also going to have to get people in the middle class who want a better life, or people who are African-American or Hispanic-American or Asian-American, those of us who are running for office have to communicate, these policies are designed to help you, and we are for you.
If you had a time machine and you could have gone back to one moment and said, that's where I wish I'd said this or done that, is there a thing that gnaws at you a little bit?
You know, there's not sort of one line. I wish I'd have given this line better. But of course, there are moments in the debate. I would have loved to have gone back and rescripted in the debates that happened. But there were good moments and there were bad moments, and you'd take them both. But overall, if I were to go back and do it again, I wish what I'd been able to communicate was that everything that I was talking about was designed to help middle-income people have higher wages and have more prosperous and safer future. And so sometimes if I'm talking, and this is, by the way, a problem I think a lot of Republicans have, we're talking about GDP growth. Who the heck cares about GDP growth? All right. No one knows what that means. If you did a poll and said, what's the GDP? I'll bet half of Americans or more don't know what you're talking about.
No, it sounds like we're calling for proper accounting principles most of the time.
Exactly. And I was talking about making America the most attractive place for business and for inventors and investors and entrepreneurs. And, you know, if I'm working at a garage putting new tires on people's cars, what has that got to do with me? Well, the answer is, to get wages up for people,
right.
The only way I can get wages up for people is if more businesses expand in America, and therefore they compete for employees, and by competing, they have to raise their wages. That's the way to get wages up. But I didn't make that connection as I should have. And I'd have rather gone out there and said, look, if I had it to do over again, I'd put a stencil on my cap that said, get wages up. All right. I want to help people have more earnings. I want wages to go up in America, real wages, not disinflation, real wages. And then if they ask me, well, how are you going to do that? Now's the time to talk about GDP and innovation and ventures and all that sort of
right,
stuff.
Right, sure, plumbing
but
and wiring.
But it's, you know, yeah. That's deep. But talk about getting wages up.
I believe it too. I mean, Right to Rise. That's why we named it that. We wanted to totally have the mobility campaign. But in the primary, it turned out to be a real grievance market. Who's going to beat the hell out of the system?
Yeah, yeah.
And who's going to, you know, it was interesting. I thought the parallel between the Orange Menace and Bernie, because Bernie's going to solve every problem by smashing and destroying Wall Street. We do that, you get free college, mm-hmm. Everybody works, you can't be fired, we grow wings, we fly, it's all solved. The Orange Plague has an easy, I'm trying to avoid his name.
No, here. Go ahead, it's just fine, Mr. Trump.
All right, well, I hate the Mr. Trump thing, because you know he's telling his people, I want to be referred to as Mr. Trump. So
I give everyone
the
respect.
Staff all have to say Mr. Trump. So
I see.
We will say the apparent nominee, depending on convention outcome, Trump, says all we got to do is build a wall of Mexico and send him a bill, and then boom, everything changes. It's a simplicity conspiracy that just, in a grievance time, has appeal, but it undermines any ability to. Part of it, I think, is how cynical people are that nothing can get better because everything's corrupt. That is something we have to change so they actually have some belief that their vote means something other than who they're going to punish with it.
Yeah, I'm very frustrated with the fact that we've seen two candidates on the right and on the left with basically a demagogue approach, which is to say the reason that your life isn't as bountiful as you'd hoped it would be is because of XYZ group. And in the case of the left, it's like, well, it's the bankers and the rich people. And if we just get those Wall Street bankers to give back what they owe us, why, everything will be better. And on the right, it's like, it's those Mexicans and those Muslims. That's what's making your life miserable. And those are easy answers that are not the answer that America needs. But I understand it's good politics. Look at the numbers. Look how well people have done on the left and on the right with those approaches.
We're going to continue our conversation with Mitt Romney at the next podcast, where I will ask him the mega question. Okay, Mitt, here now is the mega question, because this is the thing I get a headache from. If you knew your vote decided the election.
That's easy.
Well, it was great to talk to my old friend Mitt Romney. Next week, we're going to have part two of our interview, where we talk about the future of the Republican Party, about Donald Trump this year, and how we get out of this mess. But until then, oh, that's the sound. The Republican thought police is here to enforce orthodoxy. They want to shut us down, need to escape, but here is our dilemma. This is a cul-de-sac. There's no way out, and the Pacific Ocean beckons. That's a long swim back to L.A. Where to go? Wait a minute, I got it. Let me grab this remote here. I'm going to hide in the car elevator. We're going to escape to the basement. I'm going to step inside Mitt's pristine American Motors Rambler here, shut the door, click the button, and we're descending into Mitt's basement. A lot of Romney bumper stickers stacked up here. He may not be out of politics after all. Now it's closing overhead, and the thought police will never find us. So until next week, remember, victory will be ours.
Radio Free GOP. The resistance.